you know, the addition of Wiggs and Kelly has changed everything for us defensively. It's just, it's allowed us to compete every night at that end. And if you can't do that, you can't win in this league.
We're going to bring y'all into our huddle.
You are in Warriors Huddle with me, Bram, with me per usual, my boy and producer Marcus.
What's up, Dub Nation?
And our master of all things sound, Maxime.
How's it going?
Boys, you guys are both sounding fired up to be on today. You're already making me excited. Even MT's tone of voice got me juiced. Well, boys, you aren't the only ones excited. I am too. I am fired up to annoyance that rejoined us, the Golden State beat writer for the San Francisco Chronicle, a man who attends every single Warriors practice, shoot-around, press conference, and game, and a guy who isn't afraid to meet Mark Medina in the ring, Mr. Connor Letourneau. What's going on, Connor?
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Of course, man. How you been? It's been a while. We missed you.
I know. I missed you guys. I've been good. You know, it's been a interesting season with all the protocols and the working remotely, but the Warriors are keeping things interesting, so that's good.
Am I crazy to say, so one of the signature qualities of MT's appearance on this show is his unique, deep voice. I felt like in that, hey, what's up, Dub Nation? He sounded genuinely fired up to hear from you, man. Am I the only one who thought that, or what?
It sounded genuine to me.
MT, were you faking it?
No, it was genuine. I'm pumped. I haven't talked to Connor in a long time, and I'm super interested to hear how he's taking that Medina call out.
Yeah, well, so far we haven't been able to get him to take the bait, but we will, gentlemen. There's a lot of Medina-related content today, and I'm going to start with a segment we haven't done forever, one I'm really excited to do with you, Connor, because there's some clarity I need. And the section is this, the off-the-court report. For those who are familiar with the show, know exactly where we're going. Connor is not only a great guest, he has unbelievable access to this team, and that's true even in the middle of a global pandemic. While most of us, including national writers, are stuck at home watching this stuff on TV, Connor can attend each of these games in person, and that's been true in this young season. So for this segment, we're going to try to take advantage of Connor's unique access and figure out what the hell it feels like to be at the arena for these games. Let's set up the obvious. Connor, you've been going to the games. You've been at Chase and experienced this personally?
I have, yeah. It's a weird environment. I definitely learned the hard way the first time around that I need to bring a lot of food, because we're at the arena for 5-6 hours. You know, you have to get there especially early to go through the coronavirus testing and the waiting and all that, and they don't have any food at the arena. All they have is water bottles. So my first game I covered there this season, I could barely focus on writing because I was so ravenous because I didn't bring enough food. So you know, just part of the learning curve with this new reality.
Are you sitting with the rest of the press? I mean, I imagine you're not alone, right? So there's other people either to your left or your right?
Yeah, the press is much more spread out than it used to be, obviously, keeping 6 feet of distance between reporters. But I'm right next to our boy, Wes Goldberg, and Janie McCauley from AP. So I'm still able to see some familiar faces, which is nice.
I imagine, and maybe this is just me adding a story where it's not there, but I imagine that not everybody moves at the same, I'm going to need food here speed that you have. Have there been a couple of times where you've brought food and you notice people looking over at you super longingly, like, you bastard, I'm crazy hungry and you actually have something right now?
Wes, literally the other day, had to get up and leave the arena and go to dumpling time in front of the arena because he was going to pass out if he didn't get food. So
I love that. I would absolutely eat it in his face as much as I possibly could. Like, this is so great and it's so stupid you didn't bring it. But, tell me more about how you actually get in. What's the testing process like? How long does that take? Cause at some point I would imagine this is in our future as fans as well.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's honestly a huge hassle, and I'll be completely candid with you right now. I might not be at every single home game the rest of the season. I mean, I might only be at the majority of them, but not every single one, just because it's a lot of hassle for very little payoff. I mean, yes, you're in the arena, but you don't see the roar of the crowd. You don't see that, all those types of scenes. You don't see anything away from the court. You're not in the locker room. You don't have that kind of behind the scenes access. I tell everyone the biggest reason why I go on the road during a normal season is for those, you know, behind the scenes conversations where you're getting information, you're getting to know the guys more on a personal level at shoot around, at practice and games. And that just doesn't exist right now. So basically the way it's set up right now is, like, let's say it's a 7 p.m. game. You need to get there at like 3:30 to get tested. And you got to wait in line and then get tested, which takes a little while. And then you wait 45 minutes. I've actually had to wait upwards of 90 minutes some days to get my result. They pull you aside once they have your test back. They individually call you down. You feel like you're being called to the principal's office, and they have a healthcare worker who has a slip of paper, and she pulls you aside into a corner behind the stairwell and hands you a slip of paper that says you either have COVID or you do not have COVID. And if you do not have COVID, you can take that slip of paper, walk down the street to the media entrance and go into the game.
Sounds like the Hunger Games.
You go up to the game and, there's no food. There's no sort of real media room set up like there used to be. And honestly, it's inconvenient because, you know, the music's blaring. There's no real quiet place to work. So I find it hard to like transcribe or do my job pregame. It's in a lot of ways, it's just way easier to be at home, watch the game on TV, and you know, have a sandwich, you know, or something in your kitchen than it is to go through that whole process. Honestly, the biggest reason why I'm continuing to do it is because I just think it's good to be getting tested on a regular basis.
Waiting 45 minutes is just a non-starter for me. Just hook, line, and sinker. There's no way that the logistics of that really match up. Let me ask this. So once you've made it in, you wait the 45 minutes, you've smuggled in your food, you're finally in the seats, you're watching the game. What's the environment there? And let me do a better job of asking. I saw the other day the telecast did a big job of showing that James Wiseman's mom was coming to his first game. And it kind of opened up this possibility that it's not just the people who are working the game. Maybe there are some real fans there. Are there family members? Are there friends of the team? Or really, with the exception of a couple of people, is it just people who are employed by the teams?
Yeah, I mean, it's literally core family members. I mean, you're talking your wife and maybe a kid or two. And then the actual staff members associated with the team. There's only about like a dozen or so media members there. It's been really interesting from that perspective, because you normally have dozens and dozens of media members. And now you only have like the real core people, the beat writers really, and a couple TV people. That's pretty much it. I mean, it's nuts. I mean, even some of the players are having a hard time getting all their family members in.
Marcus, Maxime, would you want to go? So we just heard that description, and the Warriors have looked incredible. So let's say you somehow won tickets to show up as one of those people who's very close to the team. So you're going through the exact experience that Connor just described, 7 o'clock start, get there at 3:30. You do get to watch the game, but let's say it's from upstairs. Do you roll?
I do, but I think that's, I have a biased opinion because I don't have to go through it. It sounds like from Connor's version of the story, it's just, it's a lot to go through on a consistent basis. So I'm sure I would want to scale back how often I go through it too. The benefit of getting tested and having that peace of mind would be worth it, but it's also still a lot. And I'm like Connor, like I need certain kind of elements and quiet, and I'm a routine, a creature of habit when it comes to what I need to get work done. So if any of that is thrown off and it's loud and there's, you know, not the things that I need, I would struggle. So I would probably go, but I'd probably end up scaling it back just like Connor was saying.
Yeah. And let me just say, I came into the season telling myself I am 100% going to every single home game. I feel like I have a duty and obligation as a one of the main beat writers to be as at as many things as I possibly can to get as much access as I possibly can. And I realized very quickly there just is very little payoff. I mean, it's just not really that beneficial. And everyone I've talked to who's been has really agreed with me.
Maxine, what do you think? They talk you into it?
No, they didn't. I completely agree with Marcus. I think it would be great and the novelty would wear off pretty fast. The thing that interests me about going to a game like this is being able to be close enough to actually hear what's happening. You know, to hear Draymond yelling at each of the other players on the court, putting them into position, all of that sort of stuff is really fascinating to me. But it's a big arena. I can't imagine, Connor, that you're even close enough to hear that kind of stuff, especially because they got to space you all 6 feet apart. So it doesn't seem that worth it.
We're kind of in the club level seating area, so yeah. We're still pretty high up. And, you know, they pipe in all that crowd noise and stuff, so you really can't hear much. I mean, I don't really think that going to the games has helped my coverage, to be honest with you.
If I could go from just 7 to 10, I'm there. I like sporting events. I love the Warriors. I could be entertained just by watching the uniqueness of an NBA game without fans. At least once, I'm there for that. But I'm not going from 3:30 to 7. The idea of waiting 3.5 hours before my experience starts, no, hard no. I'm out on that. And let's use this to push us into a new segment, one I'm going to call a glass half full, although you can go the other direction. And the idea is pretty simple, because hopefully you're going to be revisiting it. What I want you boys to do is look back at your Warriors experience over the last week and give me something you liked and something you didn't like from how the Warriors were playing, or from something even more general to give you some time to think. I'll go first. A lot of things I liked, boys. That comeback Clippers win was one of my favorite regular season wins of all time. The fact that James Wiseman almost blocked a hook shot from Serge Ibaka, that they literally needed a replay to determine that it was goaltending, is mind-blowing to me, and I loved it. From what I can tell, the only reason you take hook shots is because they cannot be blocked, and that fool forced them to go to the replay because his athleticism got him close. Also, as a random aside, Serge Ibaka's facial hair really bothers me. It's just way too perfect and jumps off the screen. I felt like I was having some like HD TV problem, but I'm not picking either of those. Here's what I like the most. I love that they beat Toronto while Steph Curry was having a burger shooting night. Going into the year, even after they had had success, even after they had beat the Clips coming back from 20, it felt like there was no leeway for mistake with the Warriors when they're playing the better teams. Steph needed to play like a MVP. The defense had to be absolutely impeccable. And what we learned against Toronto is that's not necessarily true. If the defense steps up, if the second unit shows the way they did, this team can actually win games without Steph Curry being, you know, superhuman. And what that suggests for the rest of the year is just awesome. I will save my something I didn't for a little down the road here. Connor, what's something you liked?
You kind of stole mine. But
no, I went first on purpose. I took the easy one.
One thing I really liked is Andrew Wiggins' evolution. You know, he was a huge storyline entering the season, especially after Klay Thompson got injured. You know, you got to keep in mind, this guy's role changed massively in the matter of a few days, you know, after Klay's injury. He went from being brought in largely to be just kind of a better version of Harrison Barnes, where he's an off the ball slasher who, you know, plays hard on defense and knocks down the open jumper and makes a simple pass, to suddenly you need to be a legitimate bona fide number two option to Stephen Curry. And, oh, by the way, you need to be a lockdown perimeter defender who can, you know, make life difficult on the league's best scorers night in and night out, when you're a guy who historically has a reputation for being average to below average defensively. So he had a lot on this plate. And after, you know, a little bit of growing pains the first couple games of the season, he's really started to come into his own. He's shooting over 40% from three, which is really important. He's finding his shots in the flow of the offense, but he's also, you know, settling in as a little bit of a playmaker for that second unit on those high screen pick and rolls. And then he defensively has been a revelation. I mean, you saw flashes of it a little bit in his 12-game sample size last season, but you know, he has been by far their best perimeter defender that so far this season. He was great last night against Toronto. Obviously made that big stop in the waning seconds against Pascal Siakam. So they needed him to have arguably the most efficient year of his career on both sides of the ball, and he's doing it so far.
Is there any truth to the rumor that the key to his turnaround was that he listened to our New Year's Eve resolutions podcast? I've seen that floating around out there. Do you know that's true?
You know, he's not Kevin Durant-esque. He hasn't he hasn't admitted to me that he watches or listens to Warriors Huddle yet, but he probably does. I mean, everyone does, right?
It's only a matter of time. MT, what are you saying out there?
I agree with Connor on the defense. So to say something new, I really like Draymond's approach to this season. When we did the predictions podcast and we were guessing how many technicals Draymond would have and, you know, how many times he'd kind of fly off the handle, you know, we did the normal up in the teens, double digits. And so far throughout the season, we've had frustrating moments in games and times when somebody didn't rotate and you could just tell Draymond was frustrated or he had a clean swipe and they called a foul and he didn't blow up. You know, he still was loud and he still has that passion, but it isn't over the line to the point to where he's getting teed up and he's showing up the refs. Like there's been a few times where it was a questionable call and he just walks to the line and lines up and gets ready to rebound and box out. So I just like to see that growth and maturity because I think it's helpful for all the other players now that they have a year under their belt, like the Pascals and some of the people who are with the team and, you know, just showing what the culture can be. I think it's a positive step in the right direction. I just like to see it that, you know, there's going to be times when the calls go against you and it'll hopefully even out. And the best thing to do is just quarterback that defense on a string, have everybody flying around and doing it like he's doing so right now. And then just let the chips fall where they may and hope that, you know, it's even when it's all said and done. So I just like that attitude from him and he hasn't lost the passion, but he's lost some of the over the line antics.
And you've got to figure that Draymond, amongst his, you know, many talents, is he's probably a great judge of his audience. He has a sense of what will motivate and what will not. And if he's looked at this group and realizes it doesn't need to be a fire and brimstone approach, you know, this is how I think I can speak to my team through the refs. I trust his read on that. And it looks like it's working, by the way. That looks like a pretty motivated bunch. Maxime, other side of the coin, what do you see out there you don't like?
Wow. Man, thank you for letting me out of that because there was slim pickings left in terms of what I liked. Though I have to give a shout out to Damian Lee because I feel like he's ultimately like had the game on the line now twice, right? With that three-pointer dagger and then with the free throws.
I might start calling Steph the brother-in-law. We certainly can't call Damian Lee the brother-in-law anymore. You know, like if nothing else, dude, he's earned the right to play his way out of that joke. I hereby promise to not use that joke, at least throughout the course of this episode.
Wow. I mean, that's a win right there. Congratulations, Damian Lee.
Big things. Yeah. I'm sure Wiggins will tell him all about it after listening to this episode.
In terms of what I don't like, look, I mean, it's the obvious one that I'm sure we're going to need to talk about, but it's just blaring so hard at me that I can't say anything else. And that's Kelly Oubre's just abysmal shooting percentage where, you know, and I've watched him play right in his previous stints in Washington and in Phoenix. I know what he's capable of. And I'm expecting him to get back to better pastures, but it is absolutely brutal. I mean, some of these shots, quite frankly, I think I could almost hit on par. And that's a bit of an exaggeration, but not much. I mean, they look legitimately bad. They're not rimming out. He's barely hitting the rim at all.
Connor, do you know whether or not the Warriors are considering bringing in Maxime to take those shots instead of Kelly?
Of course they are.
I mean, he doesn't have the pedigree that you do, Bram, Mr. starting high school player in the Oakland Public League.
Kelly isn't. No, I mean, Oubre isn't from Oakland, so we can't really hold that
against
him.
And real quick, just statistically speaking, Bram is 0 for 1 from the free throw line at Chase, and I haven't taken one, so I'm technically 100%.
Completely fair, and let me make this a real question to you, Connor, because I'm going to add to it and then ask you what Oubre's attitude seems to be behind the scenes. His shooting is what it is. It's getting insane now and really frustrating. And it makes me nervous every time he fires one up. But I'm sure he wants to make it. And I'm sure, you know, ultimately that'll even out. The thing that drove me crazy this last week is that it doesn't really seem like he knows exactly where he should be on the floor. There was a clip that went pseudo viral where Steph goes into his corner. Oubre is still there. And Steph seemingly, who knows, you couldn't hear him, slaps Oubre on the ass and seems to be saying, get the f*** out of my spot. I'm supposed to be here. So my question to you, Connor, is this. How does Kelly seem to be dealing with the lack of shot making behind the scenes? Is he getting frustrated? Does he seem to know that this too will pass and he'll be fine? What's your perception?
It's hard to answer that because of what we talked about earlier.
Sure.
There's just not a lot of behind the scenes access right now. I can tell you that when he is on video calls with media and he's asked about it, he seems frustrated. He even said early in the season, like after the first couple games, you know, you guys are over here like trying to make up headlines, and it's like, dude, you understand that when they acquired you that their luxury tax went up almost $80 million. So there's a certain amount of pressure and scrutiny that's going to come with that. And you're not being asked to be Klay Thompson, but you were the next best option in terms of trying to replace Klay Thompson. So the fact that you're shooting 13% from three on a high volume is going to be something we have to write about and talk about. It is what our job is. I'm not sure if he doesn't understand that or if he's just kind of using it as fuel or as motivation, which a lot of players do. But yeah, no, I agree with you, Bram. He still doesn't seem to have a great grasp on the read and react system, while all his other teammates, a lot of other newcomers, seem to have picked it up in the past couple of weeks. He's kind of the one lagging behind. And I personally also think, not just to turn this into a bashing session for Oubre, but I think his defense has been way overrated. You know, there's people who are trying to be nice to Oubre. You know, Steve Kerr, understandably, will always go out of his way. Whoa, but he's been good defensively. Has he, though? I mean, he's been average defensively, especially when you look at him next to Andrew Wiggins, who, in my opinion, has been great defensively. He's had a lot of lazy closeouts. He's been ball watching. So I have not been impressed so far, but it is early and things can change.
I wonder how crazy Oubre is, and I'll just use myself as an example. So first, let me say I am happy he is here. I'm still happy they spent the $80 million to keep him here. And I have confidence that he is going to add to this team and that things are going to get a lot better. But if I'm going to agree with Connor, I'll start with this. I didn't expect Kelly Oubre to contribute to the offense as much as Klay Thompson did, but I did expect him to do a little bit more than Mike Mulder. And right now, Mulder might be the bigger contributor, which is a little bit frustrating. And here's the example I'll draw. You know, towards the beginning of the year, we were taking shots at both Wiggins and Oubre. So for lack of a better analogy, it was kind of like they were both in the slow reading group. But now we fast forward a couple of weeks, and Wiggins is like this star pupil. He's out there like writing dictionaries, and Oubre is still having difficulty with the word me. You know, like there hasn't been any signs of him getting better, and it's starting to get a little worrisome. Marcus, how long do we give Oubre before we think to ourselves, all right, he cannot contribute from a shooting perspective? We've got to figure out a different role for this guy.
From a shooting perspective?
Yeah, like stop having him be in the corner. Do we allow this, just if he keeps shooting sub 30%, do we just keep slamming this round peg into the square hole and hope the shots start falling, or do we ever flip what we need from him?
I think you have to give him at least half a season, and that seems generous to let a shot fall, but it'll kill his confidence if you immediately start game planning him around to different locations on the floor based on that. The few threes that he has hit have come from the corner, so I think you want to keep him there until the confidence comes back up. The mechanics look good. He's got, you know, a nice arc on the ball, so it's just off and it's frustrating. And I haven't analyzed it as much as Connor has, obviously, but the defense looks good to me. I mean, I probably wouldn't say that if I looked at it as deeply as Connor has and, you know, paid attention to closeouts and off the ball activity. But I just like his tenacity, and he seems to try to make up for it on the other end. And I think that's going to help him. So I give him until at least halfway through the season for him to learn the system, learn how to play with Steph, for him to get, you know, either into the corner and other people to move away, or for him to go, you know, to a different part of the floor if D. Lee and other people are going to be in the corner and knock those down more consistently, and just let him get the flow back. Because I think he's a better shooter still than, you know, obviously what he's doing, and I think he can be easily above 34-35%.
I mean, it seems to me, what's our end goal, right? If our end goal is this year, have as much success as they can have this year, get as high up the Western standings as they can, then waiting until halfway through the season on a guy whose shot may not come, not the best approach. You know, we might lose a lot of games to other teams who are in the bottom half of the West, and that ultimately costs us. But if our goal is to get back to championship level, and this year is getting people acclimated to the system so that when Klay comes back and they get Minnesota's pick next year, we can hit the ground running, then they better figure out how to use Oubre in that role, because that's how they're going to be the most successful, is getting that shot to fall and then getting his defensive shortcomings up to speed. So I agree with you, but man, 36 games is a lot of games hoping that a 30% shooter gets back up to speed, yeah?
Yeah, and, you know, I said entering the season that one of the most important stats to watch this season is going to be the three-point shooting from both Andrew Wiggins and Kelly Oubre. Obviously, with Klay out, they need someone to fill that void along the perimeter. But, you know, this is a team that, when at their best, is going to want to be out in transition, and they're going to be wanting to take a lot of transition threes. And, you know, a lot of those are obviously going to be funneled through Wiggins and Oubre, and that's exactly what has happened. And Wiggins is making them, and Oubre is not even close. I mean, and you look at the analytics, he's, I believe, averaging 5.3 three-pointers per game, last I checked, and 5.2 of those on average have been wide open, meaning no defender has been within 4 feet of him. So no one, they're not even guarding him, and he can't. And if you look at the shots, they're not just not going in. They're not even close to going in. I mean, they're not necessarily a lot of air balls, but they're way back iron or way front iron. You know, they're not even close. And I do think he's going to figure it out, but it's concerning, you know, it's going to be really interesting if this rut lasts for another few weeks or so, because more and more pressure is going to be put on Steve to make a change, which would be a enormous decision should he do that, because you're risking potentially creating a ton of locker room issues and making Oubre unhappy, and you know that can be really scary.
Oh, messing with a guy's confidence whose confidence is already lacking, you know, that's a black hole, and you got to worry out for it. Just based on those answers, Maxine, please make a note and do a little research for us. See whether or not those first few times Connor went to the game, he did in fact bring a lunch, and Kelly Oubre just stole it from him, which is why he hates him so much. It's going to be a hard thing to figure out, but I want you to get to the bottom of it. Boys, let's move to our Warriors Oracle section. Old segment for the audience. Connor, new one for you, although the idea is crazy easy, man. This is a mailbag. The only thing that changes it is that people also tend to throw us random and personal questions. Let me prove that to you. Here's our first. Peter in Concord writes in to ask this, quote, have you ever seen someone you know and like out in public, but cross the street anyways so you don't have to talk to them? Peter, this one really landed right in my wheelhouse. I do this, well, we don't leave the house anymore and we don't see anybody. So I'm going to take this question as asking, when we were still in public and we were walking down the street, did I ever do that? I did that every day. I work in the middle of downtown San Francisco. Because of that, I see a lot of people I went to graduate school with. And I would say on at least a once a day basis, I would see somebody walking down the street, like on my way to lunch or something, and then casually come up with a bullshit reason to cross the street and then put my head down so that we did not recognize one another and did not have a conversation. And it's not that I didn't like them. Like, I'm still on board. I consider him a friend. I just didn't feel like having an actual human interaction. Am I the only one like this? How about you guys? Do you ever do this?
I can confirm that that's how you are, Bram. So for the listener out there, I was going, I would take the ferry to work sometimes from Oakland to San Francisco. And I get on the ferry one morning and in the corner, I see this huge North Face puff jacket that can only be Bram's jacket, the one that he wears, which is way too hot for how cold it is in the Bay Area.
It's the only cold jacket I have.
And I go in there and there's a bunch of open seats and, you know, this is pre-pandemic. So, you know, you can sit next to people and I literally go sit right next to him and he's not paying attention. And he kind of looks at me weird, like who is sitting next to me? And then he sees it's me and we start laughing. And it was 51%. He was happy to see me. 49%. He was upset that I messed up his morning commute to be alone. So Bram and I are probably best friends and have been so since we were five. So the fact that he does that and crosses the street is 1,000% true.
Could not be closer. Also, I'm glad I was able to come up with a facial expression that convinced you that 51% of you wanted to have that that conversation. I was like, what was happening? Also, I was crazy hot because of my jacket, but you know, it was what it was. How about you? Does the fact that you sat next to me show, do you not do that? Are you always happy to see people out and about?
If it's somebody that I like and, you know, like have a good relationship with, yes. I mean, I've crossed the street or I've just put my head down if it's somebody that I'm like peripheral friends with, you know, just, you know, like tier three and below. But otherwise, yeah, I'm just going to say what's up and say hi. So I haven't crossed the street that many times. I usually just go with the head down.
I'm willing to bet almost any amount of money that Maxime absolutely has crossed the street before and that Connor has not, that Connor stays on the side of the street and has the interactions. Let's find out. Let's start with you, Connor. What do you think, man? You see somebody out there, you're going to have a conversation. How do you handle it?
It honestly totally depends on who the person is. If we're talking about someone that I'm friendly with, but I'm not like actual friends with, you know, like an acquaintance that you're on okay terms with, but you're not, you know, inviting to your birthday party. I'm probably not going out of my way to say hi unless I know that the person saw that I saw them. You know what I mean? If you make eye contact, you definitely got to do something. But if you can get away with not making eye contact and making the person believe you didn't see them, then I think you should probably just move on with your day. Because you're not going to get anything out of, you know, 30 seconds of small chat when you probably have things to be doing. It's there's just nothing beneficial about that.
Oh, no. Well, and for me, if I get stuck to that 30 seconds, I start making all these guarantees that are never going to happen. Oh, it's so great to see you. We should definitely hang out. I'll exchange numbers for no reason. I mean, you know, it's this really awkward, unnecessary, sweaty experience. Maxime, at least tell me I'm right about you. Do you cross streets or what?
Of course. Of course.
Let's go.
But okay. There's something I need to point out here, which is that Marcus referred to these tiers. He talked about a tier three. I'm proud to say that I'm at least tier two because I was running around my neighborhood once and he drove by and he stopped and we had a chat. So I made it. But the one thing that I do think is problematic here, to Connor's point, is the situations when you make eye contact and then you still cross the street. Right. Which to me says that the other person was just as uninterested in making contact with you. And that really kind of f***ed with me. You know what I'm saying? Because now I have in my head like, oh, like they didn't want to talk to me.
The real reality on this thing, you know, that this entire question presupposes that I am way more important than I actually am. Chances are when I see that person walking down the street and they see me, they're thinking to themselves, oh, shit. There's Bram. I do not want to talk. And they're so happy that I cross over. And all of this just presupposes like, oh no, they desperately want to talk to me, you know? And I am positive that is not true. Let's veer back to basketball for this question. Carol in Oakland asks if you could add a completely healthy Klay Thompson or a completely healthy Kevin Durant to this Golden State roster, who would it be and why? MT, did you take it first?
Jeez. Oof. If I want to win a championship, I add Kevin Durant. If I want to stay true to the Splash Brothers and be loyal to the soil with our boy Clay, then I had Clay, and I lean towards the latter. I love how good we are with KD, and you know, Steph and KD shattered records, and you know, both. I think there's only been teammates that have scored 25 plus points per season, you know, a couple times throughout history and throughout a season, and Steph and you know, KD did it three times, and the other teammates have only done it once each. So it's a potent combination, but I'm just partial to the Splash Brothers. I love the loyalty that Clay showed us when he re-signed the contract and gave us that, you know, Gordon Gekko quote, you know, from Leo DiCaprio. He's the man. He's part of the culture and part of the family. So I'm going to go Clay, but begrudgingly, because I think KD would give us a better result.
Connor, put on your Steve Kerr hat. Pretend you are Steve Kerr and give me his response. What do you think he would say to this?
He would be incredibly diplomatic and probably find a way to not fully answer it. But I think if he was being, honest, and that's not a criticism of Steve, you know, being a public figure like that, you got to navigate carefully. Clay, foundational to the franchise, is that he's the glue together. They're still doing decently well right now, but I can tell you, if he was available, we'd be for conversation. I think that they would be a legitimate title contender right now, and they're still very much feeling his void, not just on the court but off, you know, internally in terms of the locker room and the plane flights and all that kind of stuff. So I think they would all take him. And also keep in mind, like, Kevin, it was always Kevin Durant and the Warriors. It was never the Warriors. It was Kevin Durant and the Warriors. He never felt like a part of the fabric of this team, and he was always kind of a mercenary during his 3 years here, a very good one at that, but he never really was one of the core guys. And so I don't think they really miss him that much. You know, obviously it'd be nice to have his skills, but they don't really miss having him around that much.
I'm going to pick Clay. I don't know if I'm just being optimistic, but if I squint really hardly, I think I can even see why Clay may be a better advantage to the Warriors to win a title, even to address what MT's saying. So MT, obviously, yes, you want your homegrown brother and you want to show him solidarity, especially at a time when he's recovering from his second career-threatening injury. But the other side of this thing is, if you look at it on the defensive side of the ball, you know, KD was incredible, but where he was incredible is where Wiseman now is. He erased mistakes at the rim, whereas Clay was a perimeter savant. He made up for all the things that Steph couldn't do against the game's best guards. And now that we have Wiseman erasing shots, blocking hook shots improbably, then if we needed somebody, some inclusion on the defensive end, I think it's perimeter wise, and I think I would pick Clay. And, you know, again, I am a homer, and this is probably a homer take, but that's the direction I would go. Let me go to another question. Bram in Oakland asks this. I'm getting ready to put $100 on Steph to win the MVP. Am I crazy smart or just f***ing crazy? So, gentlemen, I'm sure you've seen right through it. This is not a write-in question. This is, in fact, me. I am going to do this. I'm going to do this today. I've got $100 in my account. Here is the odds. Steph Curry is plus 1400. So if I bet 100, I'm going to win $1,400. Just to give you a little sense, Luka is plus 400. So bet 100 to win 4. Giannis plus 450. KD plus 800. LeBron plus 1200. Connor, am I crazy or does Steph have a shot at the MVP?
He has a shot. For sure he has a shot. I mean, if he keeps these numbers kind of close to where they are, and the Warriors, you know, get into the playoffs and maybe get into like the 4 to 6 range in terms of the playoff berth, I think he at least deserves a spot in the conversation. I mean, this is a team, outside of yesterday, their success was directly tied to his success. You know, they won every game where he had 30 or more points, and they lost every game where he didn't have 30 points. And so if they exceed expectations, it's going to be largely because of him, and he's going to deserve some credit for that.
You know what I've really been enjoying about his season? So one of the most impressive things to me is if somebody doesn't brag unless they are forced to. Let me give you a dumb example. Let's say you own like the nicest Tesla on earth, And then you go to a friend's house and they have a super nice Honda. And before you can say anything, they're like, look at this Honda. Look how awesome it is. And it is brand new. And it, they tell you all about it and how much money they spent on it and all these things. They're doing everything they can to show you how awesome their car is. But even though you know you have a Tesla, even though you know you have a nicer car, you say nothing. You compliment their car. You ride in it. You say it's amazing. And then you fast forward 5 or 6 months. They, for whatever reason, have to stop by your house. And at that point, they casually see your Tesla. That's baller to me. I love that. I love if you can keep something in pocket. You don't have to show it unless they see it. And then they feel bad about having not known about it. That's Steph season. We spent all these years knowing that Steph was good, but we also spent all these years praising his teammates, saying that he couldn't necessarily carry a team on his own, calling him things like a system player. But while that happened, Steph didn't need to show you his Tesla. He didn't fight back. He didn't say, you know, I'm just doing what the system asks of me. He didn't do any of that shit. He just stayed quiet. And now, when we're finally in his house, when we need him to do these things, he's showing us what he's capable of. He is slowly revealing just how good he is. And I just love that. It's another reason why I think this season has been, for lack of a better phrase, phenomenal television.
Yeah, I think he's definitely in the conversation, and he's earned it. I don't think it's $100 well spent. I think it'd be better just giving it to me, and we can ride the ferry together and buy drinks there. But
I tell you, I'll give you $100 if you never sit next to me on the ferry again. I'm not just giving you $100. I mean, we might be able to buy something for that hundo.
I mean, if you're gonna put it on Steph to win the MVP, you are giving away $100.
I'm using the winnings to buy a new coat. F you.
I think that the challenge is that the NBA works on narratives, and the narrative of Steph winning again isn't strong enough. LeBron, at his age and what he's doing and the numbers he's continuing to put up on a winning team to where they are is just a stronger story. And I think it puts him above, even if Steph is having a better MVP season. I think LeBron right now is number one. And I think Luka Doncic is playing his way into shape and eventually will fight for either number two or number one and win that as well. I think Giannis winning it a third time is a little tough, even though, he's playing great as well. I just think the narrative drives towards LeBron or Luka winning it.
It's actually the narrative that gets me fired up for the 1400 I'm getting ready to win. I mean, like, if we enter this season with ESPN saying the Warriors are terrible, 14th seed, forget it, Dub Nation. These guys aren't even going to compete. And then they end up to stand on Connor's shoulders. Let's say they're like third in the West. Not probable. But let's say they're third in the West. If they move up 11 spots on the back of Steph Curry, it's going to be hard to completely ignore that narrative. Uphill climb, but maybe worth a $100 lottery ticket. Last question, Connor, and I'll throw it towards you. August in Berkeley asks us this. Now that we've seen the Warriors play more than 10 games, including contests against the Clips and the Raptors, do you think they will be a top five team in the West?
Oh my gosh, that's such a tough question right now. I would say probably I'd say no. I still think they're somewhere in that 6 to 8 range, just because of how loaded the Western Conference is, and I'm not confident that Andrew Wiggins is going to be able to keep this up. I also am not 100% confident that Steph is going to stay 100% healthy. Hopefully he doesn't have, an injury like a broken hand last season. But, even if he has to miss like 10 games or something, that would be devastating, especially given that the season is shorter this year. So I'm going to lean toward them not getting in the top five.
Maxime, I want your answer to this, but first I've got to tell you, and it pains me to do so, I just want to make sure we're on the same page. I happen to know that Marcus drives around your neighborhood all the time and doesn't always stop you when he sees you. It's kind of f***ed up that he doesn't every time, but he did do it that one time, so you two will always have that moment.
So I think the conceit here that, Connor, that you're missing is that Bram is going to win $1,400, and there's no way that Steph is winning the MVP and missing 10 games.
Truth. That is truth. So are you saying give me top five? I mean, give me a real take. Do you think they make top five?
No, I don't think we're going to hit top five. I think 6-8 is much more realistic. I do think that the West is not as loaded as I thought it was preseason. It seems like Jamal Murray is not quite as amazing as he was looking in the bubble. The Clippers seem to continue to have some internal implosion issues that we saw in Orlando. And I do think that that's something that's going to carry over outside of the bubble. So I don't know. It doesn't feel like an impossibility, but I think I'm guessing a 6-seed.
Marcus, you're going to take us home. Let me squeeze in my take quickly. The reason I think they could, so no, I don't think, if I had to bet money on it, the way I'm going to bet for Steph, I'd bet 6-8. But the reason I feel somewhat optimistic is not necessarily because of the talent they've shown, which they have, and it's not the chemistry that we've seen slowly eke up, which it has, and it's not that I think they're going to get better as the year rolls on, which I do. It's that this year is going to be a weird one. COVID is already rampaging. And instead of being really cautious, at least so far, the NBA is looking a little bit more like the NFL. They are forcing teams to play. They forced the 76ers to play a game with like 8 players. So if that's how this year is going to be, then I don't know if we can really predict this thing based on talent. I think there's going to be a lot of games played without superstars. And if the Warriors can thread the needle, if they get lucky and they're the team that avoids some kind of COVID outbreak, then for that reason, they could find themselves a lot higher up the West standings than everybody thought. But if I had to bet it, I'd probably say 6 at this stage. MT, take us home.
Yeah, I agree. I think they get the 7 seed. I think COVID will wreak havoc a little bit on some of the teams and, you know, like expose the depth or lack thereof of some of the benches for the teams that we expect to be higher up. But you look at both LA teams, I think they're up there. Phoenix, I think Chris Paul does it again with them. Utah, I think Dallas rounds into shape, especially when Porzingis comes back. I think Denver is just they're just not playing well. And once Porter Jr. comes back from his COVID, absence, I just think they start playing better. They're going to miss Jeremy Grant more than they were anticipating, but I still think that they end up with a better regular season record than us. But I think all said and done, we're a 7 seed and we play one of the LA teams or Phoenix first. And then all of a sudden, it's anybody's game at that point.
And it's we believe and know that when my $1,400 comes in, I'm taking Maxime out. Absolutely, probably Connor. And when we see you on the street, we are immediately crossing it and not inviting you anywhere for sure. Connor, you were amazing. You always are. For those out there, I need 2 questions answered. 1, where can they find more Letourneau? And 2, could you beat Mark Medina in a 2-3 minute round fight?
They can follow me on Twitter at @Con_Cron. Read all my stuff at sfchronicle.com. I actually have my own podcast, which Bram is generous enough to come on very often.
My pleasure.
It's called Warriors Off Court. And then Medina, I don't know, man. I could see Medina getting a little, playing a little, off the book. I could see him, maybe bringing some weapons that weren't allowed or something like that. But if it's a fair fight, I think I can handle him. I'm not the strongest guy in the world, but I think I can handle Medina. I love Medina, by the way. Great guy, but I can handle it.
Only because I know I'll be playing this clip for Mark, I'm going to add, knowing his long and elaborate history of graffiti and defacing murals, I don't think that your guess that he might play this dirty is totally out of the question, man. Huge fun, you guys. With that in mind, go Warriors, and hopefully we'll see you next week.
Good, good.